September 17th on a nice, summery, and slightly soggy Monday here in Mid-Ohio. Adam Lepp here, the computer guy, the person who discusses current events and other stuff with a show that we call Mid-Morning Coffee Break. I have the Maxwell House, well, actually it's the Kroger brand, but close enough, in my cup. On the phone with me is our frequent guest, Dr. Ron L. Fineman from Boca Raton in the Sunshine State, Florida, to discuss current events. And there's never really a paucity of current events to talk about when we're on the phone with the professor. I always like that word, paucity, Ron. Do you think that if I used it with Donald Trump, he'd think I was talking about dogs? You know, I know he doesn't like dogs and cats or pets, but he probably would think that paucity relates to like a dog's paws, when it actually means a lack, which I believe that's what paucity means. And so,
yeah, thank you for inviting me again.
And, you know, the opposite of paucity is plethora, meaning a lot, you know, a large amount. So.
Yes.
Sometimes we use...
Well, you have good vocabulary. I got to say that you learned well as a kid.
Yeah. And speaking of Donald Trump and social media and the English language, I guess there's this thing going around that I talked on Facebook with you and others about. Does a personal text from the Donald himself regarding the emergency alert system. And I don't know if the Donald actually goes in his phone and he just types in the phone numbers of the millions of Americans who receive this message, or if it's done through some automated system. But I was kind of wondering, Ron, are you excited as I am about getting a personal text from the President Donald J. Trump, or is it really not that important to you?
It's not very important. I'm not going to have my phone on in any case. I don't need my phone on all the time. But it's interesting. Alex Jones, the right wing nut that's been in trouble and was taken off Twitter, of course, was talking about it was a plot by Obama to have this happen. And now, ironically, it's happening under Donald Trump that this is going to occur.
Well, never a dull moment when you talk about politics. Now, Dr. Ron Fineman, a regular guest on this show, he's been on 117 times or so, and also on with Scott occasionally. And Scott Speer is the interviewer to the stars, of course. And we talk politics, current events, presidential history. Always want to do a few wisecracks about the current administration because, you know, laughter is the best medicine. And I think with the current state of the world, laughter always makes things quite a bit more enjoyable. He has.
May I point out, today is Constitution Day, September 17th, 1787. The Constitution was signed, and it's a very appropriate day. All schools, public schools, and public colleges, universities must celebrate Constitution Day with some kind of an event. And it's very appropriate at a time when I think our Constitution is under attack by President Trump that today is Constitution Day, September 17th.
Yes, and the Constitution probably is something which some politicians, not just Donald Trump, I mean, many people, probably should read. Doesn't always seem like they take it overly seriously. And I would start again with, I know we talked about him before, Brett Kavanaugh. He does speak very nicely. He is very smart and well-educated. But I think he knows the Constitution. I just don't think he feels he has to follow it, nor does he feel that Donald Trump has to obey it or obey the laws of this great country. And we
it's very troubling.
Talked about that ad infinitum last show, but I do think it's important. And I don't feel this guy should be on the Supreme Court. You know, we looked at Robert Bork and the controversy with him. It was a little bit different, where he was thought of as a constitutional scholar and also a very smart man. It was just he was so conservative. And now we have Kavanaugh, who is probably as conservative as Bork is. I mean, Ron may know more about that than I do, but he thinks he can cherry pick and pick and choose exactly which laws are obeyed, not just by the president, but possibly by himself as a potential Supreme Court justice. And it's rather...
Yes, I agree. And Clarence Thomas should not have been put on the court. He was. And now it's 27 years he's had an impact. And he also had issues about sexual harassment. And yet he got confirmed. And now we're going to have a second person on the court who looks like he's going to be confirmed. And I don't think it should happen. I just wish this woman had spoken up sooner and come out in public like Anita Hill did, and that Dianne Feinstein had made this a public issue sooner, because now it looks like it's not going to stop anything. But I really think it's an issue that should delay at least the confirmation, but it looks like it's not going to happen.
Well, we shall see. Never a dull moment, and I guess on a positive level, we never want for things to talk about on this program again. Never a paucity of topics, a plethora of interesting stuff about presidents and other individuals and things, and I guess, out of lack of a better term, stuff. Let's talk about the weather. You know, this time of year, it's hurricane season, and last year, a major hurricane blew through Ron's neck of the woods, but due to his excellent planning, he has hurricane insurance and hurricane shutters. He actually came out okay, but that is part of living
scary,
in,
though,
living in South
very
Florida.
Scary for a while.
Yeah, I mean, every part of the country, almost every part of the country, is potential serious weather. Ohio, we get tornadoes. We get remnants of the hurricanes, which we're getting early this week from the major hurricane, Florence. But we don't get what the Carolinas or northern Georgia did. It always comes up, Ron, and of course, it's an ongoing story with Puerto Rico and the paper towels and, you know, like a towel gate, I guess we could call it, and the memes we're seeing yeah. about that. And not just Donald Trump, Ron, but does the government do enough to protect citizens and businesses when we have these natural disasters, we have this weather? Do we need to overhaul FEMA and other agencies, or what are your thoughts as a historical scholar? I mean, we always look at, we say hindsight is 2020. We look to see what could have happened. The Hurricane Katrina, it's still being discussed more than 10 years later. Do we need to overhaul the system, or do you think it's okay as it is? What are your general thoughts? Is there a resolution to make things just more comfortable when these events happen?
Well, I think FEMA needs to be overhauled, and more funding needs to be, you know, brought about, and better people working for FEMA. And certainly, hearing that money has been removed from ICE, the Immigration Customs Enforcement, some money to, you know, what has been sent to ICE, I should say. I'm sorry, that money from FEMA has gone to ICE. I'm sorry, that is not right. FEMA should be a priority. ICE is separate; it has its importance, but you should not be, you know, shifting money from FEMA to ICE. And I do not think this man running it, Brock Long, is doing a good job. And the president refuses to take responsibility for the fact of the lack of follow-up. Now, of course, you couldn't prevent the hurricane, but the follow-up was atrocious, including his performance, throwing paper towels. And yet, he's blaming it all on Democrats, and it's all propaganda. And he refuses again to ever say that he's not perfect. And nobody's perfect. And the fact is, when a president admits mistakes like John F. Kennedy did after the Bay of Pigs, his poll ratings went up. In the case of Trump, his poll ratings keep collapsing down to the mid to low 30s now because he's never wrong in his mind, and that is not right because he is wrong and he needs to take responsibility and not blame everybody else, but that's what he's doing. But I think FEMA definitely does need an overhaul, yes.
So it's a government-wide issue with FEMA. I mean, Donald Trump probably not handling it well, and the people that are in his administration that are in charge of coordinating these things, maybe not the best choices, but it's flawed.
Like
on
George W. Bush didn't have good people either.
Yeah, it's flawed on many different levels, and I, you know, don't know what to say. We have natural disasters in this country, in California, with earthquakes, and earthquakes can occur most parts of the country, even in Ohio, but certainly San Francisco is perhaps known as the city most prone to them.
And Los Angeles, too.
It's kind of hard to say, and there's never a winner in this. I mean, I'm fascinated by weather, you know, as I have been since I knew what weather was. But it's much different when you look at it on the news than if you're actually there. And, you know, as a Floridian, Ron, you're aware of hurricanes. And as an intelligent person, you know to prepare, but you can never prepare fully. And there's always a surprise. And at a lack of a better way to say it, you have to cross your fingers sometimes. And you never quite know. But all of us are fascinated by weather. But when you're in the middle of something,
I'm amazed by the fact that Hurricane Katrina had 1,800 dead. Here it's 3,000, or 2,975, I think is the exact amount. And, you know, the fact is, Bush did really, after the fact, take responsibility, certainly more than Trump has. But, I mean, this is really worse than even Hurricane Katrina. It's worse than almost any natural disaster and the loss of life. And a lot of it is for failure to have a follow-up for rescue and to help people once it came through. They really were not prepared, and that is inexcusable.
You wrote on Facebook, Ron, that you feel if there's an evacuation, it should be mandatory. No ifs, ands, or buts. You leave, or you could possibly get arrested. Kind of like we have here in Ohio, we have level 3 snow emergencies where you can get arrested for driving. I mean, you can stay in your house, obviously, but you're not allowed to drive. The roads are dangerous. They need to be treated, be cleared. And in practicality, people aren't usually arrested if they are driving. And again, there's a difference between the car that I drive and someone having a 4x4 or a large truck driving. But bottom line is there are times when you should not be out on the road. Whatever you have to do, it can wait. You're putting your life in
others'
lives.
Yeah, well, these floods that are coming through North and South Carolina are taller than people's heights. So, I mean, many people's homes, I think 4,200 homes in North Carolina, and New Bern, I think it's the town, New Bern, B-E-R-N. So, I mean, when things are near water, and when your house is near water and people tell you that you need to leave, of course your home is important, believe me, we all know that, but your life comes first, and this causes them to have to rescue people, and that endangers not only the people who haven't left, but the people have to save them. And it should be a mandatory thing. You must leave. There is no choice of the matter.
Right, and I see it as like the level 3 snow emergencies. The roads are closed. You cannot drive. Stay at home. It can't nothing could possibly be so important that you can't wait. I mean, you don't have to go to work, don't have to go to school. The snow will end, it'll get cleared. Stay home. And in this case, again, it's much more serious. For one thing, we're talking about a flood that could destroy your house and your possessions, which can have a sentimental value that you can't put a dollar sign on. But it's not safe to stay at home. Do we need to maybe improve, Ron, the methodology where there is some government-funded rescues? We have methods of transportation that will let people, during a required evacuation, leave and go somewhere else. It seems like the whole system is a little bit disorganized. It's like, well, you have to leave. People stay anyway.
It is.
Then they get rescued, or tragically, sometimes they don't make it. But
14 people have died in North Carolina, I gather, or North and South Carolina.
And
that's tragic.
Take the freeways and they make all the lanes go one direction. It's hard to say, you know, and all we get here are the remnants like we're getting early this week. But North Carolina is not that far away. I mean, geographically, this hurricane hit within 1,000 miles of central Ohio. And I don't know the exact methodologies. Again, living in a more hurricane-prone area, Ron, you'd know more than I would. But you never quite know. Mother Nature always throws us a curve. But I would say, you know, maybe it's my being a homeowner wanting to be prepared and my science knowledge. If you are told it is not safe to stay where you are and that you are to leave ASAP, my suggestion is to heed that advice. I love my house also, but I love my life even more. And
of course,
I don't want to risk anything. So that's all I can really say. I guess every time one of these events occurs, we learn something, but you don't want to feel like you're learning something after the fact. Again, hindsight's 20/20, but sometimes it's better to plan ahead.
Yeah, I want to point out, I just posted a while back on Facebook about the fact that they had a meme that said, remember when everyone on the right laughed at Al Gore when he said the climate change was going to produce bigger, more destructive hurricanes? Not so funny now, is it? And that's really true. Al Gore was correct.
But Al Gore invented the internet, didn't he?
No, he never said that. That's a misunderstanding. He never said that.
Urban,
he was involved,
urban legend.
He owned the internet, but he did not invent it.
Maybe I should listen to some Frank Zappa records. I'm sure his wife is a big fan. Well, that's what she's known for, the record labels. But I'm sure Frank Zappa's up there in musical heaven giggling a little bit at his anti-fan, Tipper Gore. Anyway, Ron,
well,
you're the
separate issue.
Author of the popular blog that's been around
the
for over 10 years, theprogressiveprofessor.com, and I invite you, the listener, to read it, bookmark it. Again, it is from the left, but it's not heavily left. You know, kind of gently saying, Dr. Feynman is not Bernie Sanders. He's much more like Joe Biden or the Kennedys.
Hubert Humphrey in the past, yes.
Yeah, or even Carter, I guess, to an extent. And a traditional Democrat, but one who is open-minded to all views. And again, if you don't agree with what he has to say, he loves to get your emails, your comments, and his contact information is on the blog. And a lot of it is more educational. It's not really partisan. It's presidential history, something else which has fascinated me ever since I knew what a U.S. president was. recent blog you published, and this was on Saturday the 15th, and this hits home, Ohio, as well as two other Midwestern states, Illinois and Missouri, Nevada, and New Mexico. So we have two mountain states and three Midwest states. That's kind of interesting how there's a big divide. The Eastern Rockies kind of dividing where these five states are. The five most predictable states in presidential elections in U.S. history. Now, we know that as Ohio goes, that's pretty much how the country goes. And as I've talked before, as I was watching the election returns in November of 2016, I thought Trump would win, but I thought it would be very close. When I saw that he won resoundingly over Hillary, I knew the election was over, and sure enough, it pretty much was. It was close. Trump did not win the popular vote, but he won the Electoral College, and as you know, he sits in the White House today. We're not sure how much longer he'll sit there, but that's all part of the fun of being involved in presidential politics and current events. Now, you wrote, Ron, that it's often been said that Ohio is the crucial state in the quadrennial election process. And that is so true. No state has had the impact of Ohio, and particularly due to the fact that Ohio has participated in more elections than all states except the original 13, plus Vermont, speaking of Mr. Sanders, Kentucky, the beautiful bluegrass of Kentucky, and another state to the south, Tennessee. None of those have been as predictable in backing the winners of the election. And yes, as I said, I think when I saw that Trump trumped Hillary by a pretty healthy margin, that would pretty much be the way that it went. And sure enough, that's how it did. Although Ohio has been correct in backing the winner all but nine times, 83.3%. And, you know, there are some exceptions, but that list is very short. Now, the most recent time that Ohio was not the predictor, Ron, was actually before I was born, which means it was a long, long time ago, because I ain't no spring chicken. And that was, of course, one of my favorite presidents. And that, of course, was Tricky Dicky, Richard Nixon, over John F. Kennedy. When Kennedy won,
the only other time in the 20th century, 44, Dewey over FDR. And I wanted to point out Jimmy Carter, by winning a small margin in Ohio over Gerald Ford, we saw, like, realize, oh, Gerald Ford is not going to win an election and be president on his own just by succession under the 25th
Amendment. I think the reason why Carter won over Ford was that Ford played football for the biggest rival of Ohio State, U of Michigan, and they didn't want to vote for someone. I'm sure that was part of it. Now, my parents both voted for Ford. As I told you, my mom, she may she rest in peace, but she thought anybody with a Southern accent was a hillbilly. And, you know, Billy Carter is a hillbilly, okay? I don't think anybody would be offended by my saying that Billy Carter was a very lovable hillbilly, as you know, one of my favorite presidential siblings. But Jimmy Carter, yes, he had an accent, but he's considered one of our highest IQ presidents. He was a very successful businessman, a very good governor in Georgia. Yes, his presidency was troubled with the hostages and inflation and the energy crisis, but during a difficult time, he really wasn't that bad. And 40 years ago, he's still around, 93 years old, still building houses for
October 1st, he'll be 94 years old.
Habitat for Humanity. So, as we've talked about, he is arguably our best ex-president. And 40 years plus, he's still around, which is.
Yeah, I want to tell you, 2 weeks from today is October 1st, Monday. We'll have to do some kind of music for Jimmy Carter on Monday, October 1st for our show.
Interestingly, Ron, we look at Grover Cleveland, and as you know, people listen to this show probably have learned a lot about presidents, and I certainly have. Cleveland was the only president to serve two terms, but they were not consecutive. Kind of like when a song is number one on the Billboard charts and then gives way to another song to be number two or number three, then goes back into number one. An example, if I'm not mistaken, was Betty Davis Eyes by Kim Carnes, was number one for 5 weeks and took a break and then was back to number one for four more weeks. Well, presidents can do that also. And back in the late 1800s, James Blaine over Grover Cleveland. Again, there was no President Blaine, so that was in Ohio. And then Benjamin Harrison, who was, of course, also a president, in 1892, exactly 400 years after Columbus sailed the ocean blue, anyway, over Cleveland in a state that maybe was named after Grover Cleveland, since we had a city named Cleveland, which at that time was by far the largest city in Ohio, but didn't seem to help much because Cleveland lost, which is, I guess, kind of interesting. So this is on Dr. Feynman's blog, and if you're as interested in presidential history and tidbits as I am, I do recommend reading it, as it's been at this point with the next election in 2020. It'll be 60 years if Ohio is not the predictor of the winner, since Ohio failed to be the predictor of the winner in the election. And interestingly, Ron, there was a big gap, 1892 to 1944 and 1960.
Yes.
Are you thinking that the next few elections we're going to continue the tradition where the way Ohio goes, the rest of the nation goes, or do you see a possible turnaround?
I think Ohio, if you don't win Ohio, you're not going to win the White House. But I also think that that's the same thing now based on the states that had been won by Obama but were now won by Hillary, meaning I think as well as Ohio, there's also Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Florida. Those were won by Obama but not won by Hillary. I think if the Democrats are going to win, they have to win all five, those four plus Ohio back as Obama had done. Otherwise, the Republicans will win the election of 2020.
Interestingly, the other states in recent elections, there's been a big difference. For example, look at nearby Illinois. 2004, John Kerry over W. Bush. In 2016, Hillary over Trump. Missouri, in 2012, Romney over Obama. We certainly would expect Obama to win Illinois because he's a Chicagoan, and that was the case. But this here is for Missouri. We have Nevada, always an interesting state because it's increased in population so much, even though it doesn't have a lot of people. It grows a lot, as a lot of the mountain states do. We had Ford over Carter in 76, and in 2016, Hillary did beat the Donald. Could that be because the Donald has all of his casinos in Atlantic City, the major competitor to Nevada? Could that be why, Ron, that Donald Trump did not win Nevada?
I hadn't really ever thought of that issue. I don't know. But also realize Nevada doesn't have many electoral votes, so it's not as important as Ohio, Illinois, or Missouri. And by the way, Missouri, if you look at it, since 1900, they had never been on the wrong side of the winner of the election except 1956, which is weird that they voted for Stevenson over Eisenhower, of all people, and then never again into 2008 and 12 when Obama lost both times to McCain and Romney. So since 1900, when the last time before, only three times has Missouri been with the losing side. So Missouri is also a state not as important in electoral votes, but it also will be a center of attention, I think, along with Ohio and Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and Florida. I think Missouri would be the other one that would be most contended, and they really need the two sides to spend a lot of time in those states because they're going to be the crucial states. Missouri less so, but the others have more electoral votes, so they're important.
Now, New Mexico has only been a state for 106 years, and isn't that about the same age as,
Roberta McCain.
Right, it escaped me, but now I remember. McCain's mother, isn't she also 106 years old?
And it's John McCain. The year she was born is the year New Mexico became the 48th state, and the only times they've been on the losing side is three times, but two of them, note, were the times when Al Gore and Hillary Clinton won the popular vote but lost the Electoral College. So the only popular vote, electoral vote combination that New Mexico has been wrong is 76, Ford over Carter. Yeah. Interesting. Only one time have they been on the losing side if you count the popular vote as a factor.
Right. Now, interestingly, let's look at the other two times for New Mexico because I find this absolutely fascinating. Again, New Mexico, not a lot of people, but it's a growing state. Albuquerque is a growing city, and it's my late uncle Matt used to live there, and it's a beautiful, beautiful state. Desert, mountains, and cities that are big enough to be exciting. I would say one of our most underrated states. You don't think a lot about New Mexico, but it's a place to go to, and it'll very quickly increase on your list of favorite places. Anyway, in 2000, Al Gore beat George W. Bush, but, of course, George W. Bush is from neighboring Texas, which was kind of interesting that Al Gore beat someone who was sort of local, just one state over. Then in 2016, and as you may know, New Mexico has a high Latino population, and Latinos really aren't big fans of Donald Trump for the most part. Surprise that Hillary beat Donald Trump in 2016. Would the Latino population be the reason for that, Ron? Is that kind of logical to think that?
I would think it's a major factor. I haven't studied New Mexico in that much detail on the election to be sure what else, but I think that's part of it. But New Mexico tends to be more likely Democratic, while Arizona's been more Republican. But even so, Arizona is starting to become purple, and I think Texas is also. And over time, I think both Arizona and Texas, because of the growing Latino population, will eventually turn blue. And when Texas does, and it could already, possibly this year for the Senate race, if Beto O'Rourke, who's right now close to Ted Cruz, can win, I think once Texas goes Democratic, then it's an impossibility for the Republicans to win the White House, because that's the second largest number of electoral votes, and it's a lot to lose. So that's, I think in the next decade, Arizona and Texas will be blue, and it will be pretty likely that Democrats will continue then, not so much 2020, to win the White House.
And Arizona, a state that's growing rapidly, like Columbus here in the Great Buckeye State. Phoenix is the capital city and by far the largest city and continues to grow. It's a city a lot bigger than many people think it is. So Arizona, although it has its rural parts, is a state continuing to grow in people. And with Sheriff Arpaio and other people that are known as well-known Arizonans, whether you like them or not, Arizona certainly has charisma, to put it mildly. And if we see Arizona moving to the left, along with the very heavily populated and the second most, the second largest state after Alaska and area, Texas, moving Democratic, that's going to make a big difference. And as I see it, make it almost impossible for a Republican to win the White House. But that's all
long term. Still could happen in 2020, but later on. And the same with Georgia and North Carolina are becoming, particularly Georgia's more likely. You know, they elect Stacey Abrams, the African-American woman candidate of the Democrats. Wow, that, I mean, no certainty they will, but she's running close in the elections. It's ahead in some polls. That would be a real mind-blower. So Georgia and possibly North Carolina could also go to a, you know, more purple and then become blue over time.
And Abrams could possibly have eyes on the White House, just like Mr. Peanut did. You know, remember the Timer Newsweek cover that said Jimmy Who? Well, that Jimmy Who ended up becoming Jimmy the President. So you never quite know. Just when you think you figure things out.
You never know who's going to win out. There's so many potential candidates now, like 50-something candidates in theory, on paper, in the Democratic Party and probably 15 to 20 in the Republican Party if anybody decides to challenge Trump and or Pence. And I think it's likely.
I would say the 2020 election will be interesting and expensive.
Never boring.
in terms of campaign costs, to put it mildly.
Oh, my God. It'll be probably $4 billion. It was $2 billion, I think, for the last election. I bet it'll be at least $3 billion in costs, maybe more in the next election.
Well, I'm sure the TV stations will be very happy making a lot of ad revenue for that. That is for sure.
And we'll have plenty to talk about on this show every week.
Yeah, no question. We will not be wanting for topics. So on the 14th, that was Friday, Ron, you write about some of your least favorite Republicans. We've talked about some Republicans you like, you know, the late John McCain we talked about. You liked him, as I do. Our governor here in Ohio, Mr. Kasich. And, you know, both Bushes to an extent. I mean, probably more Bush number one, but you have respect for both Bushes. And we both like Ford and Mrs. Ford. And, you know, we don't always agree with the politics of the late President Reagan, but we agree he was a good leader, a good speaker, a good actor, and he was very funny also. And I think a little humor is always needed in these
great
times.
Great master of ceremonies, I call them. Yeah.
Then we have the Republicans that you exactly are not enthralled with. And we have Mr. Cruz. We have Marsha Blackburn, Rick Scott, and another Scott Walker, one of those first names. It's also a last name. Must not be one of your favorite names. Anyway.
Actually, I like the name Scott, but not on these people.
Yeah. Well, you like Scott Spears.
I don't think Scott Walker is the kind of person I would consider Scott. I think Scott is a good guy. I don't think Scott Walker is good at all. I think he's horrible.
So your opinion of Scott Walker is much different from your opinion of Scott Spears, one of my fellow radio hosts here.
Very different viewpoint. Yeah. Scott Spears is A+. I think Scott Walker is F.
Yeah. And our great mayor of Marion, Scott Schertzer. So we have good Scots and bad Scots. So we're going to talk more about the bad Scots.
Like anything else. It's like we have good Rons. And then we have Ron DeSantis, the Republican nominee for governor in Florida. He may have my first name, but I don't like him.
And he's running against a guy named Adam. And, of course, you know,
yes.
I like the guy's name.
I support Adam over Ron, yes.
Florida Governor Rick Scott, obviously someone you're familiar with, being a Floridian. What don't you like about him? What's the issue with him?
Well, first of all, he was convicted for Medicare and Medicaid fraud, and he paid fines, but he should have gone to prison, really. But beyond that, he has been horrible on so many issues, on education, health care. He didn't allow Medicaid expansion. He's horrible on the environment issue, and now the new issues we have, you know, with the environment in Florida. And also the issue that people who were former convicts and have paid their debts to society can almost impossible to get their right to vote back. Well, I see in Illinois, which I was surprised by, people in prison can actually vote in Illinois. I didn't know that. That's a bit extreme. I would think once you've left prison, but apparently states have different viewpoints, and Florida is one of the hardest for anyone who has a criminal record to ever be able to vote again. And he's just an arrogant man, although suddenly he's so interested in Puerto Ricans who have moved to Orlando because of the hurricane. But honestly, he never showed any concern about Hispanics in Florida before this. And I think his record is atrocious. And he only won by small numbers, like 50 or 60,000 each of these two races. And he's leaving now and running for the Senate. And I don't want him defeating Bill Nelson, our senator, our Democratic Senate, only one of four in the South, in the old South, that are Democrats. I think he's a very good man, and I'm hopeful he can keep his seat. But unfortunately, Scott has spent three times what Nelson has, so it's going to be a tough race.
We talked about hurricanes and government response. With the hurricanes of last year, Ron, the one that hit your neighborhood especially, how did Scott do? Do you think he could have done better, or is that still a weak issue with him?
I would say a C, but actually, if you really want to talk about a governor in Florida that did a really good job on hurricanes, it was Jeb Bush back in 2004 and 2005. But I'm not a big fan of Jeb Bush, but I think he was much better on handling those hurricanes back then than Scott was. And I just think, you know, it's a funny thing when you could go back, because I was not a Jeb Bush fan, and say Jeb Bush looks better. This is like saying George W. Bush looks better than Donald Trump. Everything is relative. The people in the past look better, but it doesn't necessarily make them wonderful. Just comparison, it's getting worse.
So it is relative, and as we talked about, Ron has Republicans that he does like, and the Bushes, all of them. I mean, and also we'll talk about the wives, Barbara and Laura. He likes some things and dislikes others, and the opinions of some are certainly different from others. But you are saying that Jeb Bush did a very good job with the hurricanes. And I would think when you're in a hurricane-prone state, and just like with an earthquake or a tornado-prone state, that's part of your job as governor. And not also
absolutely
encourage people that when the government says to evacuate, take it seriously. This isn't an April Fool's joke. And you'd know better than I would. That's kind of why I asked. So there are good things about all politicians, and some more than others, obviously. I know another one of your least favorite people, Ron, that we've talked about her, and I can't think you've really said anything good about her, and that would be Marsha Blackburn from the somewhat neighboring state of the volunteer state, Tennessee. So
yes.
Can you volunteer to tell us what you don't like about Congresswoman Blackburn?
She's always seemed to me to be a person who is very narrow-minded and intolerant. She reminds me a lot of Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann of Minnesota, who no longer is there, but was, I think, a disgraceful member of the House. And the thing is, she backs Trump every single possible way you could imagine. There was some discussion she might be part of the Trump administration. She hasn't become that. But now there's an open seat because Bob Corker, the head of the Foreign Relations Committee, is retiring, and her opponent is former Tennessee Governor Phil Bredesen, and he's actually very popular, and in most polls he's ahead of her, so I think this is one of those seats that the Democrats can gain, along with Arizona and Nevada, and possibly Texas, where Ted Cruz has to deal with his opponent there, of course, Beto O'Rourke. So there's a theoretical chance to gain four seats, maybe not all four, but the Democrats need to keep all their seats, or if they lose one or two, they got to gain one or two in order to get up to 51 and to be control of the Senate, and late polls indicate there's a chance they could keep all their seats and gain two of those four contested seats in Tennessee, Texas, Arizona, and Nevada, and then they would have control of both houses, because the House seems definitely going to go to the Democrats in November.
So you see Marsha Blackburn as being a bit of a puppet, or a yes yes woman. I mean, suppose, you know, yes person.
Yes, I would say she is, and I don't like her persona. I mean, you know, you react to people, we don't necessarily meet them, but you see them on TV or you see them in an interview, and just from the beginning, even years ago, my son would agree with me on this. Something about her, she just rubs me wrong and rubs him wrong. And, you know, it's just the way it is. The personality is part of it, as well as the voting record and the way they come across when they're interviewed or they're speaking on the floor of Congress.
You previously mentioned something which I almost found a bit surprising, that you applauded former Governor Jeb Bush's efforts on hurricane relief. And I said, we agree, it's one of the most important, one of the top three things I would say a governor should do when you're governing a hurricane-prone state, and the same thing for states that might get earthquakes or tornadoes. And I guess I was kind of surprised, but happy, as I, you know, I'm glad he did a good job. As hurricanes, it doesn't matter where they are, they affect the entire country. And we all have relatives and friends.
Well, that's one reason why in 16, I didn't want the Republicans to win, but I always said at the time that either John Kasich, my first so-called choice, or Jeb Bush, my second, were the only two I could even imagine tolerating in the White House. None of the others. And I thought Ted Cruz was worse than Trump on paper. I really was terrified by Cruz. I really thought at the time, I don't think so now necessarily, that he's more dangerous than Trump. So, and then I didn't care for Rubio, and I did not care for Rand Paul, who now seems to be sucking up to Trump, and it's saying ridiculous things, and he's supposed to be a libertarian. I think he's disgraceful. And of course, like Rick Santorum, give me a break, and others. So I thought Jeb Bush was at least respectable, and so was John Kasich. And back in 12, John Huntsman, when he was running, you know, at that time, I thought was really the best Republican we've had in the last 8 years to be a candidate for president.
And yesterday in your blog, you wrote about Bob Woodward, Donald Trump's attack on him, the master journalist with 45 years of excellence, falls flat. And you indicate that Bob Woodward is one of the greatest journalists and authors of modern times, and his new book will stand the test of time and veracity without any question. So what was kind of the gist of that, Ron? Is it just almost a case of Donald Trump and his arrogance getting the best of him? What's your kind of your read into that?
About his attacks on Woodward?
Yeah. Is it just Donald Trump and his arrogance? He doesn't want to look at other as closed-minded.
No, he's right, and he thinks everything's done as well is good. But the fact is, Omarosa, Manigault Newman's book has shown otherwise. Michael Cohen's guilty plea. The Trump Organization treasurer Alan Weisselberg is cooperating now. This past few days, Paul Manafort, and the op-ed, the anonymous, which he can't pronounce, I can, op-ed in the New York Times, all this, and the earlier book a year ago by Michael Wolff. I mean, I didn't mention that in this article here, but I mean, the evidence is very clear to many journalists, and now we have had inside info from many people because we have a leaky White House, and the man is really a menace and a threat, and I just hope he can be removed by some method soon. Not that I want Mike Pence, I don't. But at least I feel Mike Pence is mentally stable. I don't think Trump is, but I still don't like Mike Pence. And some people think he could be involved in this whole issue and could be forced out as well. So we could end up with the Speaker of the House becoming president, and that gives us the chance, the possibility of a woman such as Nancy Pelosi, if she's the Speaker next year, possibly, you know, taking over for the rest of the term, in theory at least.
So we're seeing this as another offshoot of Trump and his arrogance, and always wanted to be in control. I guess that's kind of troubling. Is even, you know, even Reagan, Reagan and Nixon, who were very proud, they were humble when necessary, and we just don't see that at all with Trump. It's kind of hard to say. You know, I might joke that I'm perfect, but I know that I'm not. And believe me, I know what I can do, what I can't do. And if I
far from perfect,
and if I make a boo-boo, you know, I will admit it. And
I've had students who would say to me, boy, you know so much. Yeah, I know a lot, but it's still a lot to learn. I'm always learning every day, including from you, you know, from students. I said, I'm never going to say I know it all because I'm always learning new things. And they're impressed when you say that, because that's being a normal person to realize, okay, I may be eligible as far as being knowledgeable, but it doesn't make me God, and I'm not perfect, and I could always learn, and I could be wrong, too.
Have we learned from this administration, you know, as we approach the halfway point, that one of the qualities a president needs to have is humility?
Absolutely, humility. Yes,
I just don't think we ever really.
And a sense of compassion, and a sense of humility and compassion, and these are things he lacks. You know, it's big problems. And I think it goes back to his childhood, obviously, with his whole upbringing. He's always been this way, and he's never grown up. That's why I think supposedly the Secretary of Defense Mattis said he acts like a fifth or sixth grader. I think he does.
So I think we've seen that because it never really has come up before. We think of the president, you know, as our leader. And just like with Reagan, even if people don't agree with him, and I didn't agree with a lot of his policies, and neither did you, but he was a good leader.
Yeah.
When you heard him talk, you did respect him. I mean, you understand he was the president. He's a man at the Oval Office. I guess we don't really see that with Trump, and I'm thinking even some of his supporters might say, well, we like what he has to say. We like the state of the economy. And I'll say, too, I think the economy is doing fairly well, but there's so much more to it. There is the person sitting in that chair, and it's got to be someone that, you know, at a lack of a better way to say, you'd be proud to show to mommy. And I'm not sure anybody would be proud to show Donald Trump to his or her mommy. I don't know how else to say it. Is that?
And he lacks empathy. That's a very important thing. Empathy, that's extremely important. A woman with compassion. Any decent person has to have empathy and compassion, and he has none, even for his own family. I think he would sell out his own family.
I mean, I hate to be negative. It's just I look at the paper towel thing. Are president sitting there with a 79-cent roll of paper towels that he got at Walmart, throwing them at the audience? Is that going to solve?
And they weren't even good towels. They were the cheapest towels.
I don't know. I don't have all the answers. And again, I admit if I don't know, and I don't know. But that isn't something that I think a president should be doing. And it's not funny when your home, your livelihood are washed away. So, don't know. We'll just leave it at that.
And,
you know, listener, if you questions, comments, suggestions, complaints, let me know. If you don't agree with us, that's okay. We invite all viewpoints. Adam@WWGH1071.com. And before we say ta-ta, Ron, tell our listener how to get in touch with you.
Okay, I'm on the progressiveprofessor.com, which is my blog site. I have a lot of articles on historynewsnetwork.org. I also am on Facebook under my name, Ronald Feynman, under the Progressive Professor, and under my book title, Assassinations, Threats, and the American Presidency. I'm also on Twitter under Politist, PolitHist, and I also my book is available in paperback or hardcover, but paperback is much more reasonably priced at Roman Littlefield Publishers or at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or Books A Million.
Okie dokie. And we encourage you folks to read his blog, get his book, because I assure you, it is fascinating and stimulating a brain cell or two is always a good idea. Ron Feynman, thank you again for being with us on a finer mid-morning coffee break with Adam.
Thank you for inviting me. We had a great time.
We will talk to you soon.
Okay, thanks.